WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Norman Mailer once wrote that before he was 17, he had formed the desire to be a major writer. Well, that wish certainly came true. He was famous at the age of 25 after the publication of his war novel, The Naked and the Dead. He won a Pulitzer and National Book Award for Armies of the Night, his reflection on the 1967 anti-war march on the Pentagon. He won a second Pulitzer for The Executioner's Song about Gary Gilmore. And as novelist Scott Spencer recently wrote about Mailer, for a writer to inspire the controversy and divisions that routinely orbit Mailer's life and career is perhaps unprecedented in American literary history. Some of the controversies to which Spencer refers have been about Mailer's macho code, his feuds with feminists, his venture into politics, running for New York City mayor, and his championing of writer and convicted killer Jack Henry Abbott. But the main controversy around Mailer now seems to be whether his new book is too long and if it's any good. His novel Harlot's Ghost is an over 1,300-page epic about the CIA. That's just part one. A second volume is in the works. I asked Mailer where he sees Harlot's Ghost fitting into the spy novel genre.
Harlot's Ghost is really, I wouldn't say it's an anti-spy novel, but it is the opposite of spy novels. Spy novels are always highly plotted. There are notable exceptions. Jean Le Carré's A Perfect Spy would be one. But generally speaking, you measure the merit of a spy novel by how carefully it's plotted, how cleverly it's put together. You look for the kind of craftsmanship you find in a Swiss clock. And as a result, the characters in spy novels are usually thin or improbable because they have to obey the turns of the plot. And I've always liked to work in the other direction, which is have my characters take over a novel and let the plot suffer if it must, as it usually does, because in life, as we know, people tend to ruin every good plot that's forming. And the same thing does happen in a novel. And I think it's more interesting for me that way, because I read novels to learn a little more about life rather than more about mechanisms. And a highly plotted book is a mechanism.
With Volume 2 hanging over your head now, do you not feel the same sense of relief that you like to feel when you've just completed a novel?
Well, I haven't felt a sense of relief in a good many years. No, I've been writing one novel after another. I got myself into a situation which I'm not at all unhappy about, but it is there. I have 9 children, and I'm all too famous now for having been married 6 times, and so there's a bit of alimony to pay, and the children are all going through college or have gone through. But I have to earn a lot of money just to keep going, which is fine because I think I'm essentially lazy, and if I didn't have to do it, I wouldn't be writing as much. And ultimately, I'm happy I've written all these books, although I do groan and gripe all the while I'm working on them.
I think you were one of the first great American writers to also be a media personality, and to have that personality be, in a way, a part of your art. Do you think of yourself, or at least your public self, as being one of your greatest characters?
No, I'm amused by it because people have such an outlandish idea of me, and I'm always intrigued with it. They really are so surprised when they meet me. If I've heard one remark 1,000 times in my life, it's that, you're not the least bit the way I thought you'd be. I'm a measure of how bad and inaccurate the newspapers are. After all, the sad truth is that most people who write for newspapers are mediocre writers. So the mark of mediocrity is to look for precedent. So they'll open the files on me, and whatever's been written about me before gets written again, thereby confirming the error.
But you did at some point, I think, almost make a decision to cultivate a public personality on TV, on The Cavett Show, on Merv, on David Susskind's show, saying really provocative things. I mean, you even write in advertisements. I think it was in advertisements for myself about how you'd kind of like study TV to think about how you could best come across on it and to most kind of accurately get across the thought or the emotion that you wanted to.
Yeah, but I've given up on that. I don't think you can communicate through TV. Some people may be able to, but I can't. My ideas are too...
complicated?
Yes, too complicated, too full of... too full of nuance. When you start trying to communicate through TV or, for that matter, through newspaper stories... your remarks get garbled and bizarre. I mean, whenever I read a story about myself, I generally shudder a bit. I say, oh, what a bizarre, ugly, sort of off-balance person I appear to be in that story.
If you're just joining us, Norman Mailer is my guest, and his new novel is called Harlot's Ghost. You used to always measure yourself against other writers. In Advertisements for Myself, you wrote, "It is my present and future work which will have the deepest influence of any work being done by an American novelist in these years. I could be wrong, and if I am, then I am the fool who will pay the bill." Do you think your assessment of your own work has changed over the years?
I think I'm a little more relaxed about it. Either my work will or it won't have all that huge effect. Sometimes I hope it will. Sometimes I think it absolutely won't. My real fear these days is not who's going to be the best writer of us all, but whether novel writing as such is going to continue with any health into the 20th century. I'm not sure it's going to. I think 50 years from now, novelists may be looked upon as the way most people regard poets, which is, oh, they do a very special kind of work. It doesn't have much relevance to my own life. I read a poem once in a while, people say. So I think in 50 years I can say, you know, I think I'm going to read another novel this year. It'll be a most special and peculiar activity almost, because I think television is driving everything else out.
But how do you size yourself up now when you compare yourself to the other major writers of your generation?
Oh, I think, I'm not going to name them. I think about three or four of us who may last, and I would say I'm one of them.
To many younger writers, you've become a father figure, and I wonder what that's brought out in you, different from the competitive instinct that you always had toward writers of your own generation.
Well, I'm not competitive anymore because I'm beginning to recognize that what's important is that we keep writing novels, that the 20 or 30 or 40 writers in America who have real talent keep working and keep doing more and more, because I think we're the only people who can define the country. And I think we have a duty. So I think it's good when any one of us breaks through and does a good book or a rich book. We help the others. I wish the level of our writing was as high, let's say, as the writing in Latin and South America. I mean, they have great writers there, any number of them, four, five, six you could name. And I'm not sure that we do anymore.
Your image has always been of the two-fisted intellectual, and you've said that you were a physical coward as a child. When did being manly and being able to fight become important to you?
In my second marriage, my then-wife's father had been a professional fighter, and whenever he came over to visit us, he used to say, "Come on, let's put on the gloves." He was about 20 years older than me, but of course he knew more about boxing than I did. So I learned quickly and the hard way. And then after that, I got interested in it and did more and more boxing. And I became friends with a couple of professional fighters. And finally, I've had a great friendship with Jose Torres over the years and have boxed with him a great deal. At one time, he was the light heavyweight champion of the world. Now, of course, boxing with someone who's as good as that is relatively safe because, he can handle you with no pain, and therefore he has no particular interest in hurting you. But I did learn an awful lot about defense while boxing with him, because if he tapped me once, and then if I didn't make the proper move the next time, he tapped me a little harder. So after a while, he put a great many instinctive defensive moves into me.
But getting back to that image of the two-fisted intellectual, why was that important to you, to not just be a bookish intellectual?
Well, I could answer you by saying, why not? What's so wonderful about being a bookish intellectual? If you're just bookish, there's a tendency to get terribly bitter about people who are physical. And my feeling always from the beginning was, if I want to be a novelist, I've got to be a novelist who can encompass all kinds of experience. My ambition was always, don't ever narrow down the horizons of what you want to write about. Try for as much as you possibly can try for. Learn more all the time. It's stultifying to be a novelist unless you keep opening up working with larger and larger, not necessarily larger and larger canvases, but either larger canvases or more powerful themes.
You went from Harvard into the Army. I think you fought in the Philippines during World War II.
Yes.
Was that the first time that physical strength counted more than intellectual ability in your life?
I would say so, yes. In fact, I went through... I grew up in Brooklyn, and you know, we didn't ignore strength in Brooklyn, but it wasn't. I grew up in a reasonable neighborhood, reasonable middle class neighborhood. But I do think that the what counted for more than strength or the lack of it was the fact that I went from Brooklyn to Harvard to the Army. So I went through two major transitions in 5 years. And the shock of that. And then a few years later, The Naked and the Dead was written and came out. So in a space of about 8 years, I went through three major transitions. The third being that I went from being an unknown young man to who just recently gotten out of the Army to being a young celebrity. And that was the largest transition of them all. It was extraordinary.
How did who you saw yourself as being compare when you were in Harvard and when you were in the Army?
Well, I just had a totally different view of myself. You know, young people at Harvard, Harvard was a wonderful place in those days, and you were coddled a bit. You know, we were treated as gentlemen. We were treated as young people who are going to be, without ever saying it, the assumption was that we were going to play a reasonably interesting role in life, and everybody cultivated everyone else's opinion. I remember it was an incredibly polite place and very nice, and even if you were discriminated against, you never knew it. It was all done so subtly. Whereas the Army, of course, was rough as a corn cob, and so that was a huge transition. And then I wasn't very good in the Army. I wasn't a good soldier, and I'd gone from having a rather elevated opinion of myself to a poor opinion of myself. So my ego was on the elevator in those days.
In what way weren't you a good soldier?
Oh, I mean, I just resented close-order drill completely. I don't think I ever learned to march properly or present arms or any of that stuff. And I don't know. I just wasn't a particularly good soldier. If you had 12 soldiers in a platoon, I'd be the third or the fourth from the bottom.
Was it important to you as a writer to be in the Army and meet men who weren't like you, who weren't from the same background or the same region?
Oh, I think it turned me into an altogether different kind of writer. If I'd never gone to the Army, I believe I would have written novels that probably would have been a little bit like the works of Iris Murdoch. Maybe not as good, but I would have had intricate philosophical novels with characters who, to say the least, would be somewhat extreme and distorted and intense. And going into the Army, talking in quick terms, maybe much more of a naturalist.
Was your ego intact after the military when you started to write?
No, I went through my ego was battered, and I went through the war very much with the attitude of, when I get out, I'm going to write a book about it, expose this damn Army. Now, everybody I knew in the Army was saying the same thing, but I used to think, yeah, they're saying it, but I'm going to do it. And I hated the Army. Now, looking back on it, I'd say that the Army was the 2 years that I spent in the Army were the worst experience of my life and the most valuable.
You know, you said your ego was on the elevator, you know, between Harvard and the Army. It really started to be on the elevator when you started to write. You know, The Naked and the Dead, as you say, made you into celebrity, but your next two books weren't reviewed as favorably, didn't sell as well. What kind of mood swings did that create in you?
Well, huge mood swings, but the happy end to the story is that by now I have an ego that I'm afraid is like a battleship. Just try and sink it.
Is it good or bad for a writer to have a big ego?
It has its advantages. Obviously, you can go through a mess of bad reviews. And, you know, most of my books over the years have had more bad reviews than good reviews. I'm the only major writer in America who has had more bad reviews than good reviews in the course of his writing life. So that gives me a certain a pride in it. You know, I feel, well, you know, they keep taking their shot, their best shot, and they can't do a goddamn thing. They're not going to stop me. And, you know, and you can get a little vain about it that way. But the bad part about having a tough ego is you become less percipient. Ego is a shell, essentially. And so you start to close off experience from yourself. The ideal would be to have a light, flexible ego that's there, that can concentrate in a given place to protect you when the going gets tough, but that it doesn't cut off too much. At my worst, I often feel like a turtle. I just pull my head in and let it rattle off the shell.
Right.
But, of course, I'm not seeing a damn thing except my own darkness at that point.
Huh. Norman Mailer is my guest, and he has a new novel about the CIA called Harlot's Ghost. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Norman Mailer is my guest. You know, you might be one of the few major writers of your generation who is Jewish and for whom Jewishness hasn't been a major theme in your fiction. Do you think that's true, that you're one of the few?
Yes, and I think it hasn't been a major theme, but I think on the other hand, it's informed every sentence I've written. You know, being Jewish is a state of mind. It's a way of receiving life and perceiving it and evaluating it and It affects every one of one's judgments. It affects one's style. In fact, it was Norman Podhoretz, once remarked many years ago that there were two kinds of Jews in history, he felt, if one were to speak very generally. One was the essentially Orthodox Jew who returned to tradition and was deeply enmeshed in it and thought of himself or herself as a Jew and primarily a Jew and always a Jew. And then there was the Jew who became the mirror of the time and aped the manners of all those people who were not Jewish, didn't copy them literally, but became so sensitive to the manners of those who were not Jewish that he might end up knowing more about it than they did. One example of this is, although he was not Jewish, his parents were Jewish. Disraeli is a wonderful example of that. He didn't look British, but he was more British. He was more English than the English. So in that sense, I think I would belong to that second category. I've always been interested in writing about things that are not Jewish precisely because I half understand them and I want to know more about them. But I think that, I've never said to myself, well, I'm really not Jewish. I know damn well how Jewish I am.
I think that kind of is consonant with the image of the writer as spy. You know, the writer is always looking at the people who he's not a part of.
Well, that's very good, by the way. You know, the writer is spy. I think in a way, writing about the CIA couldn't have been more natural for me because I've been a spy all my life. So I can understand spies.
The writer Blanche McCreary Boyd had an appreciation of your work recently in The Village Voice. She wrote, Mailer's work has demonstrated an aggressive sexism, and he has, as a consequence, become a cultural icon of offensiveness about women. Do you think you deserve to be a cultural icon of offensiveness about women?
Well, why don't you read the rest of her?
Oh, she loved your work. No, I just thought this was one way of getting to this issue. I should say here, she really loves your work and the new novel as well, just to put this into context.
Well, I just shrug when we get into that because she started with that to show the distance that the book took her.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as she read the book, as I understood her review, she was saying, in effect, I'm beginning to forgive him more and more because this book is so good. And finally, at the end, she was saying, it hardly matters what I think his ideas and his attitudes are toward women. I just, I love this book because it just keeps me reading and so forth. Whatever, it's hard for me to talk about a good review. After all, a man my age who's preening is kind of silly. But as far as being an icon of the awful to a lot of women's liberationists, yes, it's absolutely true, but I also think it's silly. I don't think they read me. I think they proceed on a notion of me that's very little to do with what I really write about all the time. I think if they were to read what I write, they'd be startled. On the other hand, I think the worst of the women's liberationists are incapable of reading. They're interested only in political correctness. So how the hell can they read?
I wonder if you think that the best aspects of the women's movement, the most open and least doctrinaire, have affected your view of women or your view of yourself as a man.
Oh, no question. It's been going on now for 20 years, and it's had a huge effect, some for the good and some for the bad. I think what women are maybe beginning to face now is as they gain equality with men, they're also going to be taking on all of men's problems, and a great many of men's problems are just dreary. And on top of that, since men have been, in effect, wrecking the world, let's speak ecologically, look what man has done to the natural world. The question is, once women become equal to men, are they going to then begin to direct the world into better places? There's very little evidence of that so far. One's idea of women's liberation at this point is women in trim, gray business suits carrying small attaché cases working as high executives. Isn't that the general perception of what women's liberation is about these days? That at the very least, even the most hidebound corporation has to have its token woman in a high office?
It's one narrow part of it. I want to read something that you wrote in the 1950s in Advertisements for Myself. You wrote, Fitzgerald was an indifferent caretaker of his talent, and I have been a cheap gambler with mine. As I add up the accounts, I cannot like myself too much, for I was cowardly when I should have been good and too brave on many a bad chance. And I spent my first 30 years abusing my body, and the last 6 in forced marches on my brain. And so I am more stupid today than I ought to be. My memory is half gone, and my mind is slow. From fear and vanity, I paid out too much for what I managed to learn. I may have wasted too much of myself, and if I have, what a loss. Can you update that for us? Do you ever feel those kinds of emotions that you expressed when you were 36 in that passage?
No. In the act of writing that, I was able to move away from that. You know, much of writing is I wouldn't call it exorcism, but it is transformation. Very occasionally, it's transcendence. If you can absolutely capture a state of mind at a given moment, then you very often are freed of that state of mind. That was written out of the deep fear. In those years, it was written out of the deep fear that I had ruined myself.
From
these abuses, you know, pot, booze, all of that. But I think in the course of writing it, some little part of me said, well, stop complaining so much, because actually this is rather a well-written passage.
At the age of 68, which you are now, do you feel that you have no time for certain shenanigans that you participated in when you were younger?
Oh, time is obsessive now. Not obsessive, that's too strong a word, but it's present in almost every thought I have, put it that way. You know, I don't know how much longer I have, 10 years, 15 years at most, and there's so many things I want to get done yet. So, no, I have no time for shenanigans. I've got to get the work out.
So how has that changed your public life, the public Norman Mailer?
Well, I'm much quieter now. You know, a lot of people complain secretly. They say, you know, Norman has gotten so mellow, he's boring. But I'm not at all the public figure that people think I am. You know, I haven't been in a fight in, it must be, 15 years. I stopped boxing 8 years ago. I'm a man of 68.
Has your approach to writing and rewriting changed at all over the years?
Talking about the process.
Yeah.
Well, I now look upon myself as having somewhat less talent than I had when I in the middle years, but I have much more skill and savvy, and I'm a much better editor of my own work. I'm sure that any number of reviewers would disagree, but in any event, that's the way I feel. And so I feel if I can get something written that's halfway decent, by the time I get done editing it, it'll be pretty good. Whereas in the old days, I used to write with more smoke and less savvy.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It went very quickly.
And my guest has been Norman Mailer, and his new novel is called Harlot's Ghost. It's a novel about the CIA. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.